Today's episode is dedicated to the memory of Alexander DeKeewitt, Tim Seward McGee, Tracy Morrison, Fiona Monroe, Cherise Keewatin, Dave Murray, Greg Frez, Rainbow, Otis, Wade Crawford, Sean Giroux, and Janice Warren.
When people pass and band you, you're always a member. You're always a member. We have a long, long list of members. And that's because for the revolutionary, death is not the end. Is that right, folks?
Yeah.
When one of ours passes, we say, we don't say rest in peace, we say rest in power! Right, folks? Greg Frez! Rest in power! One more time, Greg Frez! Rest in power!
I'm Garth Mullins. This is Crackdown. Episode 50. The Toll.
So last night over dinner, I told my kids about the decision that I'm sharing with you today. I intend to resign as party leader, as prime minister, after the party selects its next leader through a robust, nationwide, competitive process.
It was a cold, blustery January morning in Ottawa. Pierre Poilievre and the Conservative Party of Canada were soaring ahead in the polls. Justin Trudeau took the podium to announce that he would be stepping down as Canada's Prime Minister. And this week, the Liberal Party chose his successor.
In first place, the next Prime Minister of Canada, Mark Carney, with 100.
It's the end of an era in Canadian politics. Trudeau was in power for nearly a decade, since just before the start of the overdose crisis. And today on the show, I want to look back to describe the legacy and impact of the Trudeau years on drug users.
Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways.
In 2015, Trudeau replaced Stephen Harper as Canada's Prime Minister. We knew the new boss would be better than the old one, that Trudeau wouldn't be nearly as hostile toward drug users as his zealous Conservative predecessors. But we also knew that Trudeau was no ally and that we'd still have to fight for our community.
It is an historic day for Canada, and we are live on the ground in St. John's, Newfoundland, where the clock struck midnight first, so we were on hand to witness the first legal sale of recreational cannabis.
Over his 9 years in office, Trudeau presided over some modest reforms to the drug war. In 2018, he fulfilled his campaign promise to legalize cannabis, making Canada just the second nation in the world to allow adults to use weed without any criminal penalty. However, Trudeau and his government didn't expunge the records of the disproportionately black and indigenous victims of Canada's marijuana possession laws. And the legal cannabis industry that emerged has been rampant with corruption and inequality.
I am a frontline worker who's not been on her job the last 6 weeks because people keep dying around me and I am completely traumatized because we don't have the resources to do our work.
That's frontline harm reduction worker and friend of the show, Zoe Dodd. She's speaking to Trudeau about the overdose crisis that emerged under his watch in 2016.
This is an emergency. This is a national crisis. You are not doing enough. The bodies keep mounting, and it is up to you, Mr. Prime Minister.
For nearly 10 years, the drug user movement had urged Trudeau to take decisive action in order to curb overdose deaths in Canada. Trudeau has acquiesced to some of our demands, allowing expanded access to naloxone and providing some meager funding to safe supply pilot programs. But he never formed a systemic, coordinated response to Canada's worsening drug supply, and he inadequately funded overdose prevention sites, leaving many to seek private donations in order to keep their doors open.
And I would say, be brave. You talk about the safety of children. You talk about the safety of youth. It is young people who are dying. It is young people who elected you. Save their lives too. Do something. Seriously, do something.
At the end of the day, Trudeau's legacy on drug policy can be boiled down to a number. 50,000. Since fentanyl began taking over the drug supply a decade ago, Trudeau has presided over approximately 50,000 overdose deaths. On this show, we've struggled to describe this epidemic of death, to wrap our minds around its magnitude. A simple number can't convey the way the overdose crisis has rewritten our lives, the mark it's left on those of us that are still alive. But today on the show, I want to try. And to do that, I'm going to play you some tape, all previously unreleased, that we've gathered over the years making Crackdown.
Hi there, Scott?
Hello, it's Sam and Garth.
Hi. I'll let you in, okay? And then you'll have to push the buzzer again to come up to the 8th floor.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay.
It's October 2024. Crackdown producer Sam Fenn and I are at the home of Jeannie Seward McGee, a Buddhist, a Brit, and a member of the advocacy group Mom Stop the Harm.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Hiya.
Are you God?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
Since 2016, the mainstream media has frequently told the story of parents who've lost their children to preventable overdose deaths. And for good reason. Trudeau's overdose crisis has disproportionately impacted young Canadians, which has in turn given tens of thousands of Canadian parents an unimaginable kind of wound. The loss of a child to an overdose is an event so painful that it sets you apart from the rest of the world. It transforms you into a kind of outcast of suffering. All too often, the media has focused just on the initial cataclysm of parental loss, the first few blurry days and months of grief and confusion. But we know it takes years before these parents can hope to find their footing in the world.
As you can see here, this was Tim's hands when he was about 3 years, 3 or 4 years old, and he wrote the word Tim, okay? You know, when you have four kids, it's a family the whole time. But as they say, Tim shone. Anybody who was a relative or a friend, it was always, oh, you're Tim this or you're Tim that, because he was the star of the family. He was just a content, beautiful child. One of the things when you meet somebody new and you say, how many children do you have? And you have, I had four, but I only have three now. How did Tim die? And I turn around and I say, would you like to know how he lived?
As Jeannie speaks, she looks lovingly at her bedroom wall, at the shrine she's built in dedication to Tim's memory. There's pictures of a handsome man in his 30s, smiling from ear to ear, a framed copy of Tim's diploma from the University of Toronto, and a bill from a play Tim directed while he was at college. Tim was a bon vivant, Jeannie tells us. He loved wine, women, and adventure. And after taking a millisecond to gather her strength, Jeannie launches into the story she's already told far too many times.
We decided to take a 366-day journey around the world. We backpacked around the world. And we took two of our children with us, Mark and Tim. So we allowed them to travel by themselves. So they went off to Scotland to start off with by themselves. We went to Holland.
17-year-old and 18-year-old traveling together
why not?
By themselves.
You're what a cool year. Mom.
Yeah. It was a celebratory time for the McGee family. Jeannie, who was 49, had just retired after decades of running her own remarkably successful legal secretary business. And Tim, who was 17, was on a kind of gap year from school.
We all took this anti-malarial drug, Larium. And we were in the night that we recognized something was different here. The second pill he took, he came to the restaurant where we were and he was just totally changed. He changed from this enthusiastic, fun-loving, outgoing, you know, walk into a room and he was it sort of thing, to an anxious, depressed teenager. He was aggressive, he was not nice, he was, and in fact we said, we looked at each other and said, maybe we should just send him back to Canada.
It was only years later that Ginny learned that Larium sometimes causes depression, anxiety, and suicidal ideation. For some people, the symptoms seemed to linger on and on for years. Either way, from that point on, Ginny felt something fundamental had changed inside of Tim. He'd been a happy child and teenager, but now, entering adulthood, Tim seemed brooding, searching, and unfulfilled. Over the next several years, Tim looked for answers while traveling the world. It seemed to Ginny that Tim was on a kind of lifelong quest for spiritual healing. He confessed to his mom that he'd sometimes fool around with drugs, and then he'd developed a drinking problem, but he reassured Ginny that he was getting help.
As you see, it says, I'm clean.
Oh, so this is, right here, this looks to me as a blue, or is that purple? Blue N.A. Key fob, which means 6 months.
Absolutely.
Clean at Narcotics Anonymous.
Exactly. What happened was he was down in Mexico, and he was there with Nikki, who's his partner for the last 5 years. And he said, Mom, tonight I'm going to go to AA and get my 6 months, because he'd been talking about alcohol use. My 6 months pin or keychain or fob or whatever it is they're going to give me. So off they went. And when he came back, I said, oh, Tim, come on, show me. Show me what you've got. Oh, Mom, it's only a little key fob. You wouldn't be interested. Oh, come on, I want to see it. So out he pulls, and I said, but this is NA, that's Narcotics Anonymous. Oh, Mom, he said, they ran out of the other ones.
Oh, yeah, pull the other one.
Yes, they ran out of the other ones, so they gave me this. And I didn't, unfortunately, question. Well, one of the big universals is, if only I had of. I wish I had of. That's a big one. Absolutely.
So what's your I should have, or I wish I'd?
I wish I had, when he handed me the NA thing, said a simple thing like that. But this is NA, that's Narcotics Anonymous. Yeah? What's this about? Don't lie to me, Tim.
In the years since Tim's death, Ginny has gradually pieced together what happened next. It was December 2015, and Tim was living with his partner Nikki in Koh Phangan, an island paradise with turquoise beaches off the coast of Thailand. From the outside looking in, it seemed like Tim was on the right track. Ginny had recently managed to get him to see the family doctor for his depression, and Tim said that the new pills the doctor had prescribed were helping a lot. At that time, Tim was running a resort. Not bad, kiddo, Ginny thought, full of pride in her son. But unbeknownst to his mom, Tim was also using a lot of cocaine.
Yeah, one of his emails was to a monastery in Thailand, and where they do a total cleanse. And he was admitting what he, in his email, he admitted his own usage. And, you know, he admitted it to Nikki that he wanted to come clean. He was trying. Obviously. He said to Nikki, I just need one more night, because he had gone on a binge for 2-3 nights. I just need one more night. And she had actually not allowed him to stay with her. He was looking to get cocaine from his regular dealer in Kopanyang. So he actually found somebody who was, I've found out this since, okay, who was a drug addict for 20 years, but had actually just gone clean for 2-3 months. And Tim was desperately looking for cocaine. His own supplier wasn't there. And he went to this guy, and this guy said, yes, I do have something. And he gave it to him. He didn't sell it to him. And it was something they called China White. I don't know whether that...
Yeah. We had that here all through the 90s. It's very, very strong heroin, and some people say fentanyl.
On his iPad, which I have, he Googled how to snort heroin. And David, the next morning, woke up and found Tim sitting in, with his legs crossed in a meditative position in the chair, head down like this, dead.
Oh, Jeannie, I'm so sorry.
Nikki was 3 months pregnant, and they hadn't told us because they were waiting for Christmas, and they were going to tell us on Christmas Day that they were expecting a child. So when we got the phone call that Tim is dead, also within 24 hours, we knew that his partner was expecting a child, and they knew it was a little girl. Prior to that, when he was on the beach, he had actually seen a little girl whose name was Francesca. And he said to Nikki, that's a very pretty name. So her name is Francesca. This is a book I put together for, mostly for Francesca, all right? And I've put it together with other things as well, you know? The first time I met Tim, this person is saying here, he was thoughtful, smart, always ready to try new things, made good jokes and easy. So these are all written from friends, and I put it all together.
And when Francesca's...
She's got a copy, but her mom hasn't given it to her yet. She's too young.
When she's ready...
When she's ready.
She can get to know her dad through this.
Exactly. When you've lost a child, your world changes. It's thoughtless in many ways. You think brain fog. It's literally brain fog. You know, you can't remember things. You can't believe you're never going to see your child again, that he's not going to walk through the door and say, hi, Mum, love you, big hugs, you know, that sort of thing. The first 2 years, I can't remember them now. You can't stop thinking about how was he in the last few minutes, you know, what did he look like? All these stupid things in a way, all right? Why, and of course, why?
Academics who study loss have come up with a term called disenfranchised grief. It refers to the way certain kinds of death are complicated by shame. It's just not the same to lose a child to a drug overdose as it is to lose a child to cancer. And Jeannie says that quickly became pretty clear.
The stigma was huge, particularly from a middle-class family, you know. Why? You know, you should have brought your children up better. We didn't talk about it for at least 6 months, the cause of death.
It didn't talk about it publicly, or no. Didn't talk about it as a family?
Oh, yes, as a family, of course.
Right.
But not publicly, not outside the family. A friend of mine was telling me, she said, you know, Jeannie, the stories going around that Tim took his own life. People try to be nice, try to be understanding, but they say the most goddamn awful things.
What do you mean?
For instance, I had one friend who every time she saw me used to say, "Jeannie, how are you doing?" And it was the reaction was, "How the F do you think I'm doing?" I didn't say that to her, but you know, there was no empathy there.
It's a cruel irony. In Canada, parents like Jeannie are almost always left to feel alienated, like no one else could possibly understand what they've gone through, even as the overdose crisis has thrown thousands of parents across the country into the exact same kind of mourning. But there is almost no academic research studying this epidemic of grief, nor any coordinated strategy for addressing it. Instead, Canadian families have been left to shoulder the work of repairing their communities, largely on their own. After a couple of unlivable years, Jeannie decided, very cautiously, that she was ready to try to rejoin the world. And so she and her husband started to attend a grief group.
Compassionate Friends has been around for many, many years, and they are a wonderful organization. But when you go, again, there's this stigma that if you lost your child through a drug overdose, that it doesn't fit well with those parents who've had a child who had cancer, a child who was in a car accident, a newborn that didn't live. You feel like an outsider there. I did. I felt like an outsider. That it was my child's fault. He's using, so, yeah. You take your risks.
Yeah.
Okay?
Jeannie says, over the years, it gradually became easier to think about Tim. She eventually decided to go through his stuff. When she found something special, she'd frame it and hang it on her wall. Later, Jeannie and her husband created a small foundation in Tim's name and dedicated a bench to him in Lost Lagoon. Eventually, Jeannie learned about a Canadian organization called Mom Stop the Harm. They were run by parents who'd lost a child to overdose, and they were furious with the government for doing so little to help people in their position. The organization asked Jeannie how she'd feel about running a meeting for other parents who'd lost a child to the overdose crisis. Jeannie, who'd had years and years experience attending and leading community groups, agreed, and she held the first meeting downstairs in her apartment building's community room.
Healing Hearts is a group of mostly parents, a few siblings, a few partners who have lost a loved one to an overdose. And it's a peer-led group that meets monthly here in Vancouver. I was used to holding groups and listening deeply. People go there to be listened to truly. I try to think of a theme. If it's something like, how do you handle the death anniversary? How do you handle their birthday? That might be a discussion. You know, you've got to have some question or some pinpoint to sort of get people to talk. But some of the ones who've been coming constantly over the 3 years have said, "Oh, I've progressed this week. I had a really good week. Maybe it's because I was so busy I didn't think too much about my daughter or my son." They're chipping away to try and... No, life is never the same. But you can't... It's not as though you're going to cure or anything like that. You're just there to listen.
How much do you think about Tim?
A lot. I talk to him a lot as well. Don't I? Eh? I look at you and I say, "Hey, you little bugger. Wish you were around, though."
Mom Stop the Harm has played an invaluable role responding to grief caused by government inaction and the drug war. But like so many other organizations, they are left to raise money by themselves. And while Mom Stop the Harm has been able to start up approximately 50 groups across the country, they say they aren't even close to meeting the huge demand of bereaved Canadian families.
My name's Garth and this is Sam. We're from Crackdown Podcast, and so we're going to be... thanks for having us, and we're just going to be rolling tape all the time.
It's October 2023. Sam, Lisa, and I are in Geneva at the International Conference on Health and Hepatitis in Substance Users. We've come here with members of the drug user organization CRISM. For years, the group has been pummeled by the overdose crisis, leaving many of their closest allies and friends dead. The group has prepared a panel presentation about the grief Canadians are experiencing, about the way overdose deaths have made it much harder for the drug user movement to come together and fight. But first, we hit the streets of Geneva to do a little exploring.
Where are we going?
We're going to see the statue of the Frankenstein's monster.
This is Kathy Pinero, a drug user activist who spent over 10 years delivering harm reduction services to women and trans people in the Greater Toronto Area.
I like Frankenstein. I think it's so cool. It's his monster. So Frankenstein is friends with the gargoyles, and the gargoyles are protectors of mankind. So I'd like to go see... I'm looking forward to seeing some gargoyles.
And so Kathy, Lisa, Sam, and I march down the cobblestone streets of Geneva's Old Town, admiring the cathedrals, the unfamiliar beauty of ancient architecture. We resist the expensive cafes that beckon like sirens to gullible foreigners. And after a couple of wrong turns, we finally find the Frankenstein statue, sitting right next to a skate park.
The bolts are in the ear. Here's a bolt. That's where it gets where the electricity is supposed to go in, right?
Look at this. It's like his mouth is like stitched together or something.
Yeah, right down the side of his face. That's cool. You can see like his brain coming out the side here. It looks like a little spiral, like a squashed octopus almost.
Kathy, why did you want to come here?
It's Halloween. In keeping with the theme of Halloween, it's just, I don't know, I just thought it was cool. Frankenstein's part of Geneva. He lived here, he was made here. So he'd behave the way they wanted him to behave, he was condemned. So isn't that the way we are? You know, if we don't behave the way they want us to behave, they condemn us. And we're outcasts. You know, all he wanted was to be loved. That's all we want, to be loved, you know what I mean?
Kathy's colleague Brandy agrees emphatically. She sees herself in Frankenstein's monster too. He was a kind of social outsider, she reminds us, rejected by the same society that created him. It always works like this. First we create the social suffering, then we fear and loathe those who suffer.
Having reversed so many overdoses as I have, you become numb to it. It becomes methodical. I don't even enter a panic anymore. So have you dealt with many overdoses, or have you dealt with any?
Yeah.
It's not as shocking anymore.
It's not so terrifying. It's just like...
It's sad to say that if someone overdoses now, you know, I'll have people come knock my door. Okay, we need Narcan. And before I just be, oh, okay, now I know where it is. And I just, okay, let's go. I'm still in an urgency to get this done. But in the same sense, I'm not losing my head anymore.
But Kathy's entire community, her friends, her colleagues, her partner, were drug users, which meant that Kathy lived with constant anxiety. She knew at any time the people closest to her could die.
It's been happening so frequently that you don't have a chance to actually put closure to one before you're dealing with the next one. And I mean, I'm talking to two people a day or like three people a week.
Everybody that I know that has died from an overdose, I've wondered, like, when they are going to die.
This is Matt Bond, a CRISM member and harm reduction activist based out of Halifax.
Anticipatory grief is just really the concept of, you know, if you have a loved one who's constantly putting themselves in risky behaviors like using drugs, or maybe they're a police officer and they got to go in the line of duty, or, you know, they do something that they may never come home, so... You're in this constant state of potential grief, this feeling, this emotion that you don't really know what it is. And, you know, I'm guessing it's some kind of grief, right?
There was this one, you remember that panel that you and me were on? And it was this panel, it was called Gonzo Journalism and the Drug War. And really it was about this video that Matt had created telling the story of his life. And then you weren't there. Like, there was an empty chair, right? And I was a little bit worried at the time, you know? Why don't you fill in the rest of what happened there?
Yeah, and that, you know, that was back in, I think that was back in June, Gareth, and I overdosed, actually. That was on a Thursday, and I overdosed on Sunday, but it was, like, such a bad overdose. Took, like, 5 vials of naloxone. Like, I was just so out of it. That I was
the benzos, like a long hangover from the fucking benzo dope,
eh? Exactly, yeah. Exactly what it was. And so I was just going through withdrawal, and I was like trying to like, oh, I gotta do this. And then I looked at myself in the mirror, and I was like, I can't do this because I'm a wreck, right?
Let's not get too cute about it, right? Because it's like all of us are still in that spot. Because even today when we had the panel, Kathy was like half an hour late, and we're all worried about, is she okay, right? So it's just like we're just always thinking about each other. Are we all going to be okay? And that anticipatory grief, it's just like, it's like a little rabbit heart thumping away in your chest all the time of nervousness, you know?
Well, that's what, like I said, like, it's not like every Monday do I wonder if someone died. It's every time you look on social media, every time you're on your phone.
It's just death book.
Yeah.
I know this is like an impossible question to answer, but do you have a sense of what cumulatively the like anxiety you feel about your friends and the people you care about potentially dying has like done in your life?
Yeah, it is a hard question, but like I think about where I'm at in life and where everybody else, like I grew up at, where they're at, and you know, they're starting families and got houses and stuff, and I just feel like I'm not there, right? Like, so I feel like it has put a strain on me that's hard to like do some daily functioning things.
Can I ask, like, do you guys think that you keep a part of yourself from getting too close to people, or like keep a part of you from getting your hopes up about things?
You know, Al Fowler said, he used to be on the editorial board of Crackdown. Al said, I don't want any more friends. I don't want to know anybody else because of that constant loss. So if you don't get to know anybody new, then you don't have to lose them. And maybe I'm a bit like that, but the people who are in my circle, in my family, like I feel like definitely tight to like you guys and a few other people, and like I feel tight and connected, but like I'm sure that other people, I'm like, I probably seem like aloof or whatever. I think it takes like a long time for me to get to know people, or for people to get to know me, or like I think I'm slow and hesitant to make new friendships, you know.
Just like parents who lose a child to overdose, drug users also experience a lot of disenfranchised grief. I remember attending a funeral at Glen Haven Memorial Chapel for my friend Nick back in the 90s, during Vancouver's first overdose crisis. I'd just done a big smash of heroin to get up the nerve to attend, and I was worried that the small collection of punks, skaters, and metalheads at the back of the church would be kind of an affront to Nick's straight-laced family. But looking back, it was remarkable we were there at all. Over the years, I've helped plan dozens of funerals for my friends and comrades. And I know that sometimes the family doesn't want us there. Sometimes they don't even organize a funeral at all, leaving the task of memorializing their kid to us, their dope fiend friends. In these instances, I've sometimes tried, and often failed, to get the family to show up at the service.
Kathy, can I ask, when did your partner die?
It's been about 4 years now.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to go to the funeral. They'll remove the body from you before you even have a chance. In order to find some sort of closure for us, we have a celebration of life. The service itself is really pretty. It was just close friends.
Did his family throw? Did they?
I have no idea. No.
No.
They didn't come. I sent out the invitation. No one showed, no one responded. But there's no, I mean, I wasn't going to follow up to, you know, to be further rejected.
It happens a lot. Yeah. We're the family.
We are. And it was amazing how wonderful the funeral homes were, how they, you know, you released them the body and they took over everything. I didn't have to worry about it. The only thing I had to do was get pictures.
Did you remember one photo in particular that really stuck out to you?
I just a picture of me and him on the bed. Just, there's, you know, I used to love the way that, you know, after love making, he'd sit there and he'd look at me and he'd caress me. And just wouldn't say nothing, wouldn't, just the way that, you know, not even hold him, just the way that he just, it was just, if after anything, just the way that he would touch me, you know what I mean? It was just so soft, so gentle. So I know what love is, but, you know, I had, he loved me unconditionally. And I feel fortunate, as much as I miss him, I'm very grateful that I had experienced that. We attained one. You know, we could finish, we didn't have to say anything, we knew what each other was thinking. And I feel very fortunate that I was able to have that.
Do you realize you're holding hands with the statue there? I just thought that was really great. Like, yeah. We're getting an emotional partner.
Last year, CRISM and University of British Columbia professor Jade Boyd released a report based on their Geneva conference talk titled Experiencing Grief and Trauma in the Ongoing Syndemic. They dedicated the report to the memory of CRISM member Alexander DeKiewicz. And they argued that advocacy work, while painful, has helped them process their loss. That it's far better to keep fighting than to simply let the grief drown you.
Are you sure? All right. So welcome everybody to our discussion. It's going to be a very informal discussion on grief and trauma amongst people who use drugs.
So my name is Brandy Abel. I come from Saskatchewan. People are more likely to have long and profoundly damaging grieving processes, life-altering grieving processes, if there is complication to their grieving. So if they are not able to grieve at the time of the loss, if the loss for some reason is unusually sudden or traumatic, if the loss comes on the heels of other losses, you know, if the loss is something that can't be spoken about, like an overdose death or a completed suicide. In the case of people who use drugs in Canada right now, and especially people who use injection opioids, we are all suffering from all of those complications, and most of all, compounded grief, which is grief upon grief upon grief. We don't have time to process a single loss before another one occurs. And a lot of the time, we don't have the opportunity either to even be a part of an official grieving process or a ritual around the death. Thank you all very much for coming here to participate in this really important discussion.
The drug user movement is constantly losing our members and our leaders to overdose deaths. As I'm reading these words, I can picture a blur of faces, my friends, heroes who stood up for their community in the face of government indifference, all lost to the crisis. Charisse, Tracy, Flora, Wade, Otis, Ron, Greg, Dave, Miles. Our very capacity to fight is constantly under siege from the grave. We are being disorganized by death, by the social murder of the drug war. And we're not what we were. We are now a ghost-bloodied movement. Those of us who survive are perpetually mourning. We all have post-traumatic stress disorder. We are all exhausted, frayed, and numb. And we all need to be rotated off the front lines for some R&R. But the war never stops, so neither do we. A decade of mass death has inscribed itself on who I am. I became numb. No, that's not right. I numbed myself. I turned to opioids, as I always do, to blank it all out. And in the process, I lost my tears. It's International Overdose Awareness Day, August 31st, 2023. And I'm in Oppenheimer Park with my best friend, Jeff Loudon. A few weeks earlier, VANDU staff member Hannah Dempsey and VANDU elder Kelly White invited us to submit names of people who died during the overdose crisis. Jeff put in his friend Otis, and I put in Wade Crawford. Wade was a member of Six Nations and a land defender. He stood up against developers who wanted to build a golf course on an indigenous burial site during what the media called the Oka Crisis. And his death robbed the drug user movement of one of its fiercest activists. It also robbed me of a friend.
The first blankets here are Kelly's star blanket. And in our community, when we wrap you in a blanket, it's to send you home with our love and our hugs as well. So I'll start with Arrow Marion.
The blanketing ceremony is being led by three indigenous leaders: Carlene Thomas from Tsleil-Waututh, Mary Point from Musqueam, and Kelly White from Sunemuch. They direct us all to form a circle. There are about 50 of us here, and I knew each of these people had carried the name of a person they were missing. They carried their own trauma and grief to the park that day. In the center of the circle sat a stack of blankets. They were purple and pink, emblazoned with a star pattern. It had taken the members of the Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society an entire year to sew them by hand.
Next, we'll call upon Jeff Loudon. Jeff, if we could step forward.
Jeff is wrapped in a star blanket as more and more names are called. A parade of dead comrades. I recognize every single name. I'd even been to many of these people's funerals at Glenhaven Memorial Chapel, or VANDU.
Next, we'll call up Garth Mullins. Garth is from the BCAPOM Board of Directors and longstanding VANDU member.
As I walk into the middle of the circle, I feel the emotion welling up inside me. Years of grief buried deep as possible, trapped in my throat, in my guts, shoved down with dillies. But now it was all rushing to the surface.
Garth is standing and being wrapped in honor of Wade Crawford from the Oneida Haudenosaunee from the Six Nations.
Carlene and Kelly wrap a blanket around my shoulders and pin it at my chest. And suddenly, the dam bursts. Tears flow to my eyes and I sob for my dead friends. I feel exhausted, but also relieved. Afterwards, Jeff and I sit on the grass with other VANDU members, eating hot dogs and watching an eagle circle high overhead. Nick, Wade, Charisse, Tracy, Fiona, Janice, Greg, Dave. They couldn't be here, but I felt like I was with them again, just for a moment. Crackdown is produced on the territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. Follow me on Garth Mullins at bsky.social and Garth_Mullins on TikTok. Our editorial board is Dean Wilson, Jeff Loudon, Laura Shaver, Simona Marsh, Shelda Castor, Ellie Taylor, Delilah Grigg, and Martin Stewart. Rest in peace, Dave Murray, Greg Frez, and Charisse Keewatin. This episode was conceptualized, written, and produced by Sam Fenn, Alex DeBoer, Jade Boyd, Lisa Hale, and me, Garth Mullins. Mix by Alex Kim. Special thanks to Jeannie Seward-McGee and the members of CRISM who we traveled to Switzerland with: Brandy Abel, Matthew Bond, Kathy Pinijo, Frank Critchlow, Natasha Twinard, and Alex Schurste-Biehoff. Our academic partner for this episode is Jade Boyd. Funding was provided by the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. Theme song by Sam Fenn and Garth Mullins. All other music by Blue Dot Sessions. If you like what we do at Crackdown, please support us at patreon.com/crackdownpod. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and keep six.